Everything is emptiness, so what else is new? I mean, we've been encountering at least the idea of emptiness for a while, right? Mm-hmm. And we sort of at least hear the idea that actually emptiness is simply when we look for our own nature, this person who we think we are, or assume or carry an identity with, we can't find it. I mean, that's a very simple, direct kind of introduction to the notion of emptiness, right? We can go right back to square one here. So, you know, if I want this to be a discussion, and I want to invite conversation and have everybody share if they feel they're out at sea with this stuff and have a hard time understanding what he's saying, or don't like what he's saying, or feel irritated, provoked, bugged, perturbed, or delighted, inspired, all of these things. This is a long chapter. It's very substantial. I'm wondering if everybody read it and if anyone has any really fundamental questions about it that, or that they might want to share with us. So why don't we start with that?
I felt like there was one moment where I almost understood the emptiness, but I can't find what it was he said. But I sort of got the idea that it's like, it's almost like if somebody said, what's the most important thing you'd ever done, then the answer is, you just were things you did. There's not, they don't have a substance. And so sort of being attached to them is like,
I don't know.
But it's like abide, like they abide, and that's really important.
Yeah. Well,
the answer is,
yeah, it's a question. The answer is a question. In some sense. Does that make sense? Sure.
When I think of emptiness, I think of it's inclusive of everything. It's the opposite of the word.
The opposite of the word?
The opposite of the word empty. It's actually full.
Oh, okay.
That's what I think of when I think of empty.
In other words, it's empty of itself. People say that too. That's a way of understanding to help not thinking it's emptiness is a thing.
Right. You know. It's not a. To me, it's not a scary empty
vacuum.
Yes.
Yeah. Good.
It's full.
Yeah. Good.
Okay.
Good. Now you understand everything.
We did discuss it earlier. The kind of an openness, just a fundamental state of openness, an open dimension, which is beyond boundaries. So, you know, our mind is always making its rules and regulations. And if our mind's not doing it, somebody else is doing it. But we know other people were doing it before we did it, because we got walked into a world with lots of boxes and directions, and yeses and nos, upstairs, downstairs, locked doors, you know, prohibited areas, right? All this stuff. It's all our own invention, right? We just make this stuff up. I mean, that's what I you know, he's really saying here in terms of convention. Harry?
Yeah, you can go anywhere, I guess, with that emptiness, but maybe you can connect it to intentionality. Like when you mentioned openness, you know, and also vacuum, you know, the absence of something. And if it's everything, so to speak, you know, it's almost a play on words that is more confusing than simple. But is there intentionality in the ultimate thing, emptiness, or non-thing, whatever?
Not at this point. I mean, what I mean is we're in the introductory phase of emptiness here, where we want to really understand how it is, and there is... The one person who actually says intent And this is a very funny word. It's a guy named Long Chenpa, who was a 14th century master, and he talked a lot about enlightened intent. That's how it's translated. And the Tibetan word is very untranslatable. It's called gong. And it's about the embedded nature of awareness in everything that fundamentally is open. And I mean, to extrapolate slightly, warm, loving, intelligent, sane. I mean, that this is you know, some kind of a quality or aspect we can begin to understand. But we don't want to start with that aspect, because then we just get too caught up in ideas and thinking. And we're trying to get past thinking on some level with this. Does that make sense? Our conceptual mind cannot grasp what emptiness is. That's the first thing. When we were studying the slogans, the absolute slogans, that's basically what they're talking about. You know, you rest in the nature, you are open, and so it's kind of a discovery process. Sometimes it's talked about the space between the thoughts. When we actually slow our thoughts down, we can actually start to see the space between our thoughts, or our thoughts slow down of themselves, that is to say, we're not pushing it. In our meditation practice, then, you know, there's some kind of sense of openness. One of the things it's described as is ineffable, meaning we can't describe it. So, you know, that's just an honest statement about it. It's beyond words. At the same time, it's the most intimate aspect of experience. And it's so intimate, it's so close, it's so in our face, we can't see it because it's just around us. It's just in everything we experience. But because we never really slow down, we can't sort of grok it, as it were. Michael Levin brought the word grok a few weeks ago, if you remember, hearkening back to Frank Herbert's novel Dune from the 60s. It's a nice word. Does this make any sense? Did anyone reading this have any feeling for being able to relate to what he's talking about? One of the things we could talk about is we can get caught up in talking about, well, when he talks about how milarepa gets inside a yak horn, because it's raining. Well, what does that mean? Did he actually shrink or what? You know, it's like, this is where our mind, it's kind of like a koan in some sense that we could ponder, but I wouldn't ponder it too much. I'd get back to the more initial phases of this discussion first.
I'd sort of found the part where he talked about when he says that sort of emptiness is what's there, and then we put all this stuff in front of it, mm-hmm. and we think that's what's really real. Like what I thought about, mm-hmm. what I had for breakfast, and what I feel about people, that's the real stuff, if you could let that go, that the emptiness is what's... And I'm sort of thinking of like you could have this beautiful forest and then build all these buildings in front of it so that all people saw were the buildings and never know that there's a beautiful forest back there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're getting it. You're getting at it. I mean, one of the things he describes is that the limits of mind, what we call mind, or our logic, our linear, you know, way of keeping time, notion of self, our opinions, our sensations, and deciding what's real. So this is a very difficult topic, actually. But, you know, when we talked earlier about suffering... And the past, when we talked about how suffering is so pervasive in terms of, if we can really understand what we mean by suffering, we're not talking about afflicted by, you know, some kind of terrible disease or something, or maimed or something, but actually a state of simply being deluded and not seeing what's there as being fundamentally the simplest definition. And we talk about that we begin to realize that, so the first noble truth is that, and then the second noble truth, does anybody remember that one?
Eternal.
Sorry?
Eternal. Impermanence?
Impermanence? Well, the second noble truth is...
There is an end to suffering?
There can be cessation.
Yeah, so there's a cause of suffering. And the cause of suffering in this case is our freezing up, our throwing concepts onto something that's completely open and pure, and turning it into stuff that we think is solid and real and permanent. So, and then the third truth is a fundamental, there is a release, the possibility or the actual truth of relief of suffering, which is discovering this true nature. And then the path, which is the mode of engagement through which we can do that. So when we talk about that relief from suffering or that fundamental cure of this dreaded kind of disease we all suffer from, we're talking about actually discovering the nature of awareness itself, or mind, or reality. So in this sense, as we begin to open up, we begin to realize reality is not a problem. The Buddha said, I do not argue with the world, it's the world that argues with me. And I don't know if you sort of understand how that applies here, but if the Buddha is simply representing what or stands for the nature of things as fundamental, open and clear and actually blissful, I mean it's actually good, you know, then what's not that is our stuff that we get in between. I mean, but it's not like we're putting it out there and saying it's got these qualities. It's more like this is what we discover as we go further with our practice in the path. That's what we got introduced to with the five absolute slogans. Does this ring a bell? Do we have any questions about that one? Or, I mean, I'm sure we should. Lots of questions, obviously.
I'm not sure how to ask the question, but I get a sense of what it's like to have, you know, ideas about things that prove not to be true, right? Not to be as substantial. We've all changed our minds, for example. But I don't understand how, if these are sort of conceptions, making concrete things that aren't concrete, why is there so much consensus among us about the things that are around us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Traffic would be a mess if my conception is different from yours.
Uh-huh. Okay. Good question. Anybody have any ideas about that or how? Yeah.
Maybe. Well, we kind of have to have concepts for society to function as a society without traffic laws to be able to navigate. I think this, though, is just a realization that those are completely made up by us. They're invented. They don't exist out there in nature. We made them to be able to achieve the goal of navigating through the town in our automobile vehicles or our bikes. So it's mostly, from my understanding, it's just that we invented it. It's not something that is real. We created it.
Well, yeah, I mean, traffic in particular, right, those are negotiated agreements. I'm thinking of ones that seem less like that, right? Like, there are things we think about our families, there are things we think about, things that hold true about love, even, that...
Again, concepts.
And very real.
Well, we talked about... looking at the way our mind works and beginning to see how the structures of neurosis is hope and fear. And it translates into various states of confusion. One is attachment. You know, we're attached to things. But the reason we agree about certain things is because we're all fundamentally scared. And this came, I mean, we're talking about way back when, you know, as we began to form societies. And we all agree. We're all freaked out. Any one of us can get eaten by an animal. We walk out of the circle, and 2 minutes later, we're gone. So, you know, there's a lot of fear around that. Or the next tribe over there could just decide to declare war on us or steal the women or, you know, pillage the stash we have of our food, all of these kind of things, and you're coping with animals and diseases and all kinds of stuff, and all kinds of unknowables. And, you know, how is that different from now? We just have more sophisticated ways of having to experience these kind of fears and...
losing our job or... it's
security
stuff,
issues.
It's just a different package, which, again, we've created. It's all made to make us feel feel more comfortable with uncertainty. Really don't want uncertainty.
Are these really good truths, like that this is a chair? I mean, you can do that, you know, but it's not. It's just a concept.
It's a concept.
Right, but if I didn't think it was a chair, I would fall to the floor.
Well, you use it. You know, I mean, but the thing is, an absolute sense, absolute is beyond relative in this sense. I mean, you know, in the sense that we're trying to understand, make a distinction here.
So is this relative, the idea that this is a chair, is that a relative?
It's a concept we all agree on.
It's
We labeled it that way.
It's not a relative truth, it's a concept.
Well, it is relative. It's relative to us. We made this up. We put the label on it. So if you're an ant crawling across the floor, that's not a chair. That's some kind of a huge tower, you know. If there's a worm sitting inside here, a maggot or something, it's somewhere they're making their little home in, you know. I mean, like, who's right, you know? If it's only, I mean, how can we say the different uses of a possible use of a chair is, as far as what we sit in a chair, a cat would lie in it, you know, that would be a bed, right? We don't call this a bed, we call it a chair because we sit. But I mean, that's, in other words, the idea is that we think as humans that, as an example, that this is for a specific purpose, it's our thing, but for animals and for other beings who have different relationships to this, it's not a chair. Does that make sense?
Yes, it's a relative concept.
Yeah, there we go. All right. That's important. So, do we want to go through this, or do we have other questions immediately that pop out that you want to discuss first?
Sure, I guess. So I understand, or I can conceptualize the idea that we have concepts. Like, I understand that. But how does it, I don't understand how it really relates to emptiness. Like, I struggle with, or I have this idea that emptiness just means that I don't necessarily hold on to all my thoughts, but then I just don't, then what do you do? Well, it's a very weird concept to me to not have thoughts, and I mean, that's just kind of how this is. I guess the society that we live in is very thought-driven, very thought-provoking, and to think like to not have thoughts, and I just don't know what that looks like. I guess I'm conceptualizing it, but that's difficult for me, and I struggle with that all the time.
I was gonna put back an example of an experience you had with your grandfather. You weren't in thought the way you were describing it.
Correct. Yeah, I've had these experiences where I understand, or I don't understand, I just experience it. It's just very, I guess it's hard to, once I've had it, an experience like that, I kind of hold on to it. And I think that prevents me from understanding or experiencing it again, if that makes sense.
Because you go back to referencing the ego and experiencing it through the ego.
Correct. So it's like for me, it's when I least expect it or I don't have any expectations of a situation when something awesome or something like when I don't have any thoughts happens and it's like I feel that bliss or I feel that just complete presence. And then once it's over, my ego comes in. Then if I go into a similar situation, I'll have expectations that it might happen again. And of course, if I have expectations,
so at that point,
you're
turning it into a thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, so we're talking about not turning it into a thing. We have this word in English, reify. Wonderful word. And so, it really means to turn anything into a thing, to make a thing out of anything.
So I guess my question is, how do you piece? I don't know how to piece together the moments. So I'll have a moment of pure clarity or presence or whatever, and then I'll have like a period of like intense confusion.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I don't know what's going on.
So what happens when, I mean, the instructions are, for instance, if you encounter this in meditation, is to disown it. Let's say you have this moment of clarity. You know. Drop it, you know.
Yeah.
Back to breath. Go back. Work. I mean, okay, you have it. You're not disrespecting it or acting as though you're being attacked by it or something. You just let it go. You disown. And you can do the same thing with the thoughts that come afterwards that are taking over and going through all their stuff. Continue disowning. See, the disowning is a very interesting word that actually Trungpa Rinpoche coined, at least at applying to this situation, which makes a lot of sense. You know, we're just moving, as it were, through life, through experience, and in terms of just the sense of openness, not allowing ourselves to get entrapped by anything that would allow us to get snagged by fascination or by seduction or by rejection. We like it, we don't like it, we're worried about it, you know, maybe we're having it, maybe we don't have it, maybe somebody else has it, you know, and all of the other kinds of stuff that our mind goes through, basically trying to turn something into something solid and permanent. So it's not permanent, it's beyond permanence. I mean, permanence is a word. We don't know if there is anything permanent. If we look at the world we experience, we have no idea what's permanent. Right? Nothing lasts.
None of it. None of it.
Yeah. It's really simple. So, you know, why do we have to start turning everything into a state of permanence? Because that's where I want to look at me, my mind that's doing this, that wants something stable. I want to depend on something. If I come back here tomorrow, I want to make sure this building's here. You know, I mean, what happens? I'd be in a state of shock. Well, you'd be in a bigger state if the place was gone tomorrow, right?
It has happened.
There's a desire for control in there that you're talking about.
Yeah.
You want to control and bring that moment back. And one of the best analogies I've heard is that your thoughts and the confusion and everything is like the weather. You can't control it. And the Native Americans have a term called svaha, which means the space of time between the flash of lightning and the sound of thunder. And supposedly in that span of time, it's great mysticism, and any potential can happen in that moment, any possibility. But you can't control it, because you can't control the weather. So I like that analogy, so that when you do find that moment of clarity, that svaha, if you will, in the weather, it's there, and then it's gone, and you just wait for it to come back again.
You know?
Or don't wait. Be present.
Well, I think what we're going to do, though, is not wait for special moments. Admittedly, they seem like a big deal at first, and they can really be mind-altering or life-altering, I mean, in terms of just the impact they can have on us. But in terms of where we're going here with regard to understanding Buddha mind, understanding our own nature, is to realize we're just going to work with what we got, because it's all we have. We don't know if this great moment is ever going to come back again or not. I mean, that would assume there's a sense of permanence or kind of predictability around that, whereas actually I'm just working with exactly what's here and now. That's where we want to be. It's the most intimate and the closest we can get to anything at all. Harry.
So I would be fair to say emptiness is the experience without thought. So we're talking about how our mind intrudes and creates a representation. So let's say that split second between a perception and a formulation of a thought, whatever that split is, that's the experience of non-thought. And the reason it can't be repeated is because that outside world is always changing. And so our instantaneous non-thought gap is that unique experience of that moment. So emptiness would be sort of a non-thought, whatever happens without our mind thinking. And to me, meditation is kind of reducing the mental activity to almost zero.
Well, but you see, then you're fiddling with it, and we're not trying to fiddle with anything. We're actually trying to understand what's actually here altogether, no matter what, unconditionally. And so, yes, we start with these moments of insight, like space between the thoughts, non-thought. We have terms for this. They're called nyams, or temporary experiences, bliss, clarity, non-thought. Those are three classic kind of insights, moments of insight, moments of truth. And, you know, we think then, oh, that's it. But that's totally, we're just turning it into, trying to turn something again into a thing and saying, that's what it is. But it's beyond anybody's ability to pinpoint. So eventually you begin to realize emptiness is everything and all pervasive. It's also in the thoughts. That the nature of the thought is emptiness too.
Okay, what's the value then of, I just have one more question. What's the value of it? If it's always there and you can't explain it.
Because you don't see it. I mean, you're not...
How do you know it's there if you can't explain it? You're actually explaining it by saying it's there.
Well, you experience what you experience. You know what you know as a result of these insights. I'm sorry, Linda.
Well, I was actually going there with that.
Yeah.
I think that I'm still actually thinking a lot about non-self, which I really finally reading about it here, even though I don't really like his style. I finally get non-self, and I've been thinking about it a lot. I like it. I mean, it's very useful.
Yeah.
It's useful.
I like non-self.
It's useful. Emptiness is not useful to me. I mean, it's a mental...
What is the difference between emptiness and non-self?
There's, to me, the way I'm thinking about it, right now where I am, there is a difference.
What is it?
And, well, the emptiness being described as... Oh, this could be a dream. You're flying when you're sleeping. You're not flying when you're awake. And just think how everything is a dream. And that just seems like kind of a...
I think to build off of what you're saying, I think for me I could relate to what Mary said, that it's the word emptiness that we give a bad, you know, meaning to, but in the very same way, non-self when you think of non-self, it's not relating to anything, so you're ultimately open to everything, and you're just open, it's just openness.
But if emptiness is, I guess I'm going back to that dream analogy.
Okay, so I do want to make, he doesn't make a distinction here. He is giving us extraordinarily profound teachings which are very kind of far-reaching. If we take this back on a more step-by-step level, which is where we started, whatever it was, 6 or 8 months ago, when we started talking about discovering why we aren't relating to what's here is because of ego. And, you know, we begin to realize, well, if we actually start investigating our experience and looking for someone who's at least there, we can't find that person. And that's the non-self. Non-self. And that's called emptiness of self. So that's the first way, a direct way to understand emptiness.
Okay.
It's a very practical way. And it's a very important one because it's that that allows us to go through what we say purifying the klesha activity, you know, the emotional patterns that are completely neurotic and confusing and grasping. That what he is talking about on the second level and what we did get introduced to with those slogans is what we also call emptiness of other. So it's not only no ego, no self here. And it means no self in any of us here, but not only just us as humans. No self in the windows, no self in the sky, the street, the concrete, the cars, anything. Nothing. And so that's more pervasive. How do we understand that? Analogy is, at least that's one of the options we're given, is the dream, is to begin to understand everything as a dream. And he's offering analogies or examples of where that might occur.
And so, that's where I am. And, okay, so, but in the day, in my day-to-day existence, I deal with my realities. And I don't use, I can find a way to use non-self. I can see that. But I can't. The dream?
So when we were studying the slogans, the relative slogans, does anybody remember whether that had any relevance to the conversation we're having now? Does anybody draw a connection with that? Did anyone see how they could that could somehow apply here?
Release even the antidote?
That's one of them. Self-liberating the antidote.
Self-liberating.
That's an absolute slogan. We're talking about the very the, like I don't have the slogans with me, but you know we have 59 slogans, and you know they're supposed to indicate how fundamentally we give ourselves and our territory up. So here's kind of an interesting way of understanding this. Emptiness, what you brought up, which is so important, no self, emptiness. Well, our experience of emptiness directly is what we call mistakenly self. Okay?
Yeah.
That's really good. And then what about all the stuff that's out here? Appearance. You know? So that's what we call nature. Nature. This is sort of where we get to understanding how... okay, we did briefly go through seeing shunyata as the, what is it called? Seeing confusion as the four kayas, the supreme shunyata protection. Mm-hmm. We talked briefly about the four kayas. So dharmakaya is the emptiness that we talk about when we say self, no self, no self nature. Samvogakaya is this richness, this luminous quality of the mind, that gives rise to all the different experiences we have internally and externally. Whatever we see or experience or sense, that's luminous. We call that other. It's still the mind. It's still the nature. The nature. Now, mind in this sense is not just my mind, your mind, my little mind, you know, of all my little things I have to do. It's mind. I mean, what's nature? Nature is mind too. So we're just talking about a vaster aspect of what we call emptiness and nature. I mean, does that make sense?
Can you keep going with it?
Yeah, I think the idea.
I don't see how it's useful.
So
I want that concept to mean something really good. But
Michael, what can you tell us how your life feels different because that awareness of that.
Oh,
okay.
Interesting.
I mean, that's actually okay. That's not a bad question. Oh, well, I've had, you know, some people could say I've had a difficult life. I mean, but I think one of the things about that is that, I'm involved in training myself, just like you are. You know, we're all involved in working with what we have in terms of our experience. This is what we have. This is what we can work with. So in terms of working with no self nature, no self, when I see my mind stirring up and glomming on, and it continues because these old habits die hard, doesn't matter how long you practice apparently. but, you know, then I can recognize that, you know, you can, that's why we want to practice meditation, because we can actually start to identify when the stuff starts happening. You know, the juices are going, and hey, you know, all right. It's not like anybody's holding back on this. I mean, it just goes. You don't usually figure this out until you're already midstream, right? You're already paddling upstream, and you go, how did I get here? Right? I mean, this is the kind of thing we do. So we just catch ourselves on the spot. We just wake up. We just wake, you know, basically, the recognition, fundamentally, is where we take our meditation in action. So the meditation we're doing on the cushion, the way we simply put our experience on the breath and allowing ourselves to be there, and just be there is enough. So when we encounter these situations where we get caught up, we work with that on the spot. We're bringing our meditation practice into action. I can give you an example of, I get so mad at myself when I do something stupid. I'm fine with other people, it seems like, but I'm my worst critic and constantly on my case full of self-recrimination and, you know, for all the stupid things I do. I can see how I could justify that and say, well, I'm really just trying to make myself good and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, really, this is neurotic, I mean, fundamentally. I have to learn how to trust what's here is enough to work with. So if that means I'm learning about being asleep in the middle of a situation I've been caught up in, that's good. Does that make sense? Am I?
I don't think it answered your question.
Well, I'm not. I mean,
I'm getting there.
Huh? I'm getting
there. Okay. Yeah, more personally,
we better hunker her down.
Okay, I talk too much.
No, the more personal you can make it.
Yeah, I mean, I was bankrupt in 2002. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the moment I said, what did I do to get myself in this situation? It was like things were completely out of control. And I could see everything going this way and there didn't seem anything I could do. And, I really had to just endure and be open to it and actually do my meditation. I mean, I was doing meditation practices and I was actually employing a brain technique to actually help me make use of activate different parts of my brain that seemed to be atrophying at that point. And, you know, my meditation practice got very good and it allowed me to really get very flexible. So I went through this without, I was anticipating that it was like dying. I was like, I just might as well jump off the cliff or something if I'm going to go to bankruptcy. I just couldn't conceive of it, you know. And, I've been divorced. I mean, I could say, well, I'm a victim of, you know, my own foolishness, or my exes didn't like me enough. Maybe it's my fault. Maybe it's her fault. I mean, you know, I had to go through that passage of mostly, in my case, it was blaming myself again for feeling like I failed to be able to rise up to the situation. And so, you know, part of what this is about is a lot of forgiving. You know, you forgive a lot. You learn and you realize I'm only here to learn. What can I learn? If I don't forgive myself, then I'll never learn anything.
All that you're saying to me seems like non-self. And you went on with the thought of luminous and things don't have meaning. That's where I'm like.
I think, isn't it a sense of perspective? I mean, we could sit in the divorce, the whatever, and think that, oh my God, this is the undoing of me. And then through meditation, through a sense of opening up to the vastness of things, and yes, that emptiness, that actually it could give you a sense of a widening view on how, yes, one's actions or non-actions are putting this or that or the other into place. And then also learning how to relax into the discomfort of the situation. And through that, actually, there can be a piercing to a greater sense of existence. If that sounds kind of artsy-fartsy, but you know what I mean.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, that you get to the other side. That's what I mean.
Uh-huh.
Like, I know, I kind of know how that, I've had moments where I thought I was going to die over something, mm-hmm. or it was so incredibly painful. Mm-hmm. But if I could sit through it, and if I could breathe through it, mm-hmm. you know, that actually it's not going to kill me.
Right.
Like there's, it gets bigger.
Right. This is you're on to a really important point. The one thing that I think what we're doing to, what we're learning how to do, is we're learning how to see things differently. We create the phenomena we see by interpretation. Okay? I mean, it's true. The car's out there, whatever. There's something happening. I have my relationships or my job, my business or family or whatever, or issues about, but how I see these things determines, it shapes what actually becomes possible. So this is a process of rewiring, actually. Our traditional, or kind of like, you know, kind of we could say our default wiring is hope and fear and grasping and fixation and thinking all about me, you know, and whether I'm happy or not and why I am or not. And we're learning how to, by, you know, rewiring through Dharmic practice, how to actually change our perceptions of what we see. So two people could be in a room seeing an event, and for one person, they're seeing something they can't stand, just absolutely, you know, totally repulsive, and they're just ready to walk out. For another person, they're just willing to find out what they can learn from the experience. That's a matter of attitude, you know, right? Are they seeing the same things? Or are they, maybe they're not? I mean, that's the question. What do they see? A person who hates someone does not see the same things necessarily that a person who loves someone does, or they're putting an interpretation on what they see. But probably both. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a year away from an empty nest, so I'm going through a lot of that transition time as a parent. And I found that for me what's been most useful in the meditation is to understand that my reaction to my youngest daughter heading off to a college that might be quite a distance away, and that aversion to that, you know, that I feel that because she's my daughter. And so that my part of it is that ego, is that self in there that wants to hold on to her. And so being aware of that and sitting with the discomfort, the idea of my child being so distant that I can't have a weekly dinner with her, allows me to process that feeling without attaching to it, without clinging to it. But then also when I interact with her and she talks to me about Cornell and how excited she is about it, their astrophysics program, that's awesome. But and then part of me is going, that's an 8-hour drive. And then, but at the same time, by recognizing that myself, that's my reaction, I can go, okay, that's okay. I can put that over here. It's still there. And I can still appreciate her thrill for this university that's a distance, and allow myself to be present with her desires and what she wants. And I think that allows for me to be a better parent, because I'm not trying to cling and hold on to her. So for me, that's kind of a more modern, you know, everyday type way that I'm using emptiness.
That's a very critical time in someone's life to have. Children leave home,
yes.
And suddenly you're stuck there with, well, what, you know, you suddenly had realized you had this big identity thing going on with family and who you're relating with and how they take up your time.
Yeah.
And I mean, I could cite examples. My sister had 5 kids. They're all quite grown up, you know, grandchildren and all the rest. And you know, her phone rings every 10 minutes, and it's always somebody. So what happens if nobody calls? I mean, you know, I mean, her whole, she wouldn't know how to cope with just this vastness that's suddenly confronting her, which is, for somebody else who lives alone, let's say, is the norm, right? I mean, but the fundamental thing is we can get very tied up with our experiences, and the person alone could also be very attached to that aloneness, to the kind of experiences they have. And then they feel like, oh, I got to be around somebody. I got to give them my time. You know, I got to be considerate and all this kind of stuff.
Michael, can you just explain further the difference between non-self and emptiness?
Well, I don't think there really is any difference ultimately. But when we're talking about the first core direct experience we can work with in our meditation practice is looking for where our thoughts come from. So as we settle in and get more familiar with and relaxed with, and our mind actually settles, that's the purpose of shamatha, right? When we've been training in shamatha practice. It's called peaceful abiding. And it has to do with simply letting your mind rest, training your mind to somehow relax, let go, not worry about what it's encountering. I'm just here. I'm just coming back and using my breath to connect with right now and let be. And then we have this little gap that we talk about to introduce some kind of space between going back to the in-breath where we're going to allow whatever arises to arise. Let be, we're just going to be there for a quick second, just nanosecond, you know. And as we do this more and more, we then develop, it'll start happening spontaneously, actually. It's not like now I have to do something. It's more, you notice, you start noticing, oh, here, you know, mine is starting up again, you know, or whatever. My stuff, my storyline, you know. Here's the history of Michael Fagan starting up again, you know. Or whatever Michael likes or doesn't like, or what he thinks he should be doing or not, and all that. And you know, you start seeing all that, and you just recognize that, and you observe it. And so you train in that. And this is a very natural thing that's going to happen with your meditation. So in other words, first we would say, just basically working on letting go and relaxing. Then at a certain point, noticing all of these various thoughts. At some point, we're going to say, where are these thoughts coming from? You know, we're just going to ask ourselves. We can ask ourselves. We have a right to ask ourselves, where do our thoughts come from? Look for them. Where do they go? Where do they arise? Where do they dwell? And where do they go after that? So the deal is this. If we can find any of those places, and then you found something you can call self. But nobody in this planet so far in the history of this planet has discovered self, looking for self. There's no self. So this is an actual direct insight that each of us can have for ourselves. It's not some kind of only the province of the very wise or special people who are elect or whatever. It is just basically the way it is in everybody. And so that's when we say no self, right? And when we say that, we mean emptiness of self. Emptiness. That is emptiness. So that's the first step, because we need to know, we got to start with where we are. We can't tackle phenomena until we actually look at who's creating the phenomena. I mean, if you throw a dog a stick, they'll run after it, chase it, right? They may or may not bring it back, but the idea is that they go after it, right? If you throw a stick toward a lion doesn't go after the stick, right? He looks at who threw the stick. That's the difference. You get that? That's really a perfect way of describing what we're doing here. We're actually looking at where things originate. And so we begin to realize we can't find where they originate. They don't start from anywhere. They don't, and when we look for dwelling, do they dwell anywhere? Let's just find out if they dwell anywhere. Take 10 minutes of your meditation and practice. Where are my thoughts dwelling, you know? Just give them a chance to get up and do their thing and keep on looking to see where they dwell. Do they have a texture? Do they have a flavor? Do they have a color? You know, I mean, just keep on looking, inquire. And as we continue directing our inquiry, we discover we can't find anything.
So, Michael, is that then something you can't find where it originates? When you say that, is that emptiness?
Well, we'll say that's emptiness directly. That's a good starting point. Because we're trying to understand how we can know emptiness personally for ourselves. And it's not a theory that, you know, is out there somewhere. So that's why the first part of this chapter, the Buddha spent so much time actually didn't think anybody could understand what he experienced, right? Shakyamuni. After he spent that night, you know, who knows how it actually happened, but it happened. And then he's going, who's going to understand this? Nobody gets this. Everybody's trying to do something. Everybody's trying to figure it out and fix it. You know, there's nothing to fix. There's nobody there. And there is no problem when I actually begin to investigate all of these elements. And so, at that point, he was hitting the absolute. So, in his case, it was like very all-encompassing. For ourselves, I mean, I only speak for myself, it's a journey. We get glimpses, and we work with the glimpses, and we learn about, you know, the path and about the nature of our mind through these glimpses, and then the glimpses get bigger and bigger or more frequent as we continue our practice. That's why it's so essential to practice. It's not like I can just sit down and go, even if I did 3 months of meditation, say, well, that's enough, I don't need to do anymore. I mean, life is constantly happening. The mind never stops. We can't seem to ever find out when it's going to stop. The mind, when we sleep, it's not stopping. The mind is working when we sleep. We certainly know it's working when we dream. When we're in our deep sleep, we don't know. But actually, brain scientists, there's occurred quite a bit of activity going on, even when we're in our deep sleep. There's a lot of processing that goes on. So mind never stops in terms of how we experience the brain, for instance. And as I did want to remind everybody, when we in Buddhism talk about mind, we're really talking about mind here, right? We talk about mind, not mind. But we certainly, the brain is certainly a part of mind, if not the whole thing. So there's a much greater, there are many greater dimensions than what we call the brain. And the brain is a very interesting instrument, but it's an aspect of what our mind is. So our habits are sometimes seemingly wired into our, I mean, we're looking at neurological theory and science and trying to understand how we get these reflex reactions and habitual kind of patterns that we explore or, you know, and manifest in different circumstances. And but we know fundamentally when we talk about, as we get more familiar with more familiar ground with his teachings, we're going to find one of the words that's used for emptiness is essence.
Is what?
Essence. And that's a really good way to understand essence. No self is essence. No self, no ego is fundamentally essence. So it's actually a way of understanding how we're here. I mean, it's not like we're somewhere else and dreaming we're here. You know, this is it. So, you know, that's part of owning up to that truth. Nobody's trying to deny what's going on. But just go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, it's so interesting because when I, with the word essence, it's like get to the very essence of something. Get to the very, it's like clarity.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's distilling.
Right. Yeah.
But is it also, like last week we talked a lot about a change and expectation and assumption and,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, I mean, like one example, this is kind of a small example, but I took my in-laws to see their old house on the Cape. Mm-hmm. And they were all disappointed because it had changed.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, and so I guess then, you know, like you're talking about inquiry in terms of, like, we have to take that further about how the house was once made of wood and then, you know, like break it all down completely to the ground.
Yeah.
But is that in the line of emptiness? Is that in the whole discussion of emptiness, is just to see about how things change and impermanence?
That's one aspect of it.
That's one aspect of it.
Yeah, one aspect is impermanence. That everything and everything that arises, he brought up in the very earlier chapter, is causes and conditions. Everything that arises is arising as a concatenation of causes and conditions. You know, and what is causes and conditions, or what is compounded, is going to basically fall apart. It's impermanent. It's just the nature of impermanence. So impermanence is one fundamental aspect of emptiness. Another aspect of emptiness, which is not separate, but another highlight of that, is what we call interdependence. That everything is not, there's nothing that you can find that exists of itself. Everything is a combination of other things at different times, at different places, and they're all dependent on those things to actually fundamentally be understood or isolated in terms of giving it a label or a mark, right? So we know that that aspect of interdependence is also empty. That's another way of describing of emptiness. So we have two ways already. Existentially, you know, that translates in terms of loss. We had something, no longer there, you know.
So the constant danger or trap of, you know, considering emptiness is to reify it. You used that word earlier. Isn't, are we all making...
this is a defense. A defense mechanism.
It's a hopeless journey to try to reify it.
Well, we do our job. We do a good job. We work as hard as we can.
That's why the search is...
Never stop!
That's why the search is hopeless. We're constantly trying to reify.
The search is hopeless?
Yeah, the search, you just said, if you look here and it's not there, you go...
No, that is it. There's no problem. When you actually see that, that's it. That's the good news. You're actually hitting gold. This is it,
So emptiness exists.
When you realize your thoughts don't come from anywhere, there's a lot of freedom that suddenly has just dropped in your lap. This is the actual thing that happened. Now, many of us are frightened of freedom. They don't want to deal with that kind of, we don't want to deal with that kind of boundless freedom, that there's no rules and it's just, open. That's when we say openness, right? But if we begin to realize that this is actually our true nature, this is the nature of reality, we begin to find out, now, unless you really have just decided that you really don't want to deal with reality because you've got a lot of things that you don't like about it, which means you haven't really explored it very far, but you feel like your mind has been shaped enough that you don't want to go any further. It's too painful. That this is not a good path, then. You need to have, you probably need to have some psychological investigations professionally and help, because this is where we actually take responsibility for our experience. This is what we're doing. This journey, we're actually taking responsibility for our experience. We can do that. Isn't that fantastic? If you really kind of just think about it for a minute, that I actually could take responsibility for my life and stop passing the buck and blame everybody else for my problem. I could just let it all come back here.
Yeah, but you're jumping from non-conception back to conception.
No, I'm working with non-conception is what gives you the freedom to actually, this is the freedom, because as I see how trapped my mind is in the habitual patterns of expectations and disappointments and anticipations and desires and accepting and rejecting, hope and fear, all of these things are entrapments. I'm just constantly, as I see more and more of how the mind works like this, it's totally entrapping. And then as I begin to discover where these thoughts come from, which is nowhere, it means it's all just like a charade, or it's a
waste of energy.
Chimera. It's chimerical.
Right.
It's like the paper tiger kind of thing. And at that point, it's like, wow, this is open. Of course, it doesn't always feel like, at some point, there's a certain time when you can sort of see this as a relief. Sometimes you'll say, oh my God, back to breath, right? Because we're talking about our experiences and where we may be at any given time. It's not like we're always somehow in the same place. We have a body, we have emotions, we have fine, subtle energies that are constantly in a state of flux, and those things in form are kind of, they're the proscenium where everything sets up in your, proscenium, theater, stage, and you're looking at basically stuff that comes up and takes on the characteristics of those momentary issues. So,
We're in a house, we're in a box.
Yes.
We like boxes.
Apparently.
We've already come here, we're in a box.
Yes.
So we like creating other boxes.
Yeah.
So it makes us feel at ease, or gives us a sense of structure, mm-hmm. while we're in this box.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of our instinct, I hate to use that word, but it's kind of, because we're already in senses,
mm-hmm.
we're sitting in here, we're looking for other things that's tangible, mm-hmm. that we can have structure to.
Mm-hmm.
And the point that you seem to be making is, forget about the box, this box, forget about those boxes, and be open to the vastness of everything. And not worry about the boxes anymore, including this box. Yes?
I don't know if I want to say that. One of the things that you learn about when you study the Dharma is that having a human body is precious.
Oh no, I'm not saying get rid of, obviously not get rid of the box, but it becomes
porous.
Yes.
It becomes what?
Porous.
Porous. Yeah. Yes. That's good. Transparent. Kind of open. Yes. I think that's good. Yeah.
Okay.
That's good. I mean, one of the ways we can rest our mind, at some point we should do a walkthrough meditation of if you meet Anam Tupten, teacher who comes in August, he'll talk about this. He gives people guided meditations, and there are ways of, first of all, establishing being in your body is very important. This is just basic, simple meditation. And then you can begin to actually just experience and rest in your senses. So the experiences of just sitting, the sensations, and that is a form of resting in itself. You can actually rest in your sensory experiences perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. And then you can, this is good training, and then you can open yourself up to a sense of vastness, like an ocean, which is fundamentally limitless. And then you can also rest as a mountain. These are actual teachings that come up later on, maybe you'll find. But they work with this just resting, of just absolute resting. And the resting is fundamentally learning how to train in the essence. So it's not an end in itself. We're not just simply only resting for its own sake, but we're learning how to tame our minds first. As we do that, then we can bring that integration into our experience. And so, for instance, when we walk, part of the reason we do walking meditation is to actually move and move in awareness. And all we're doing is just feeling movement, heels and toes on the ground, and basically experiencing moving through space. It's really, really simple. But, you know, it's like it's an engagement. And then the next thing we're going to do is when we leave, we're all going to get in our cars or whatever, and we're going to go switch on something else, right? Can we bring our meditation with us when we go home, turn on the lights, you know, have to cope with whatever we encounter when we get in the door? I mean, this is part of what we're going to learn how to do. So we're bringing our meditation further and further into whatever we do.
So I'm sort of curious about... We've used a couple synonyms for emptiness, but emptiness is the way we talk about it. It's really unappealing sounding to us, to me, anyway. Is there something important about describing it that way? That is why it's all the teachers, many teachers use that language?
Well, in the 19th century, they used the void.
That's a better, even weirder word.
Voidness. Yes. But that's hard too.
Right.
Empty, actually, well, this one teacher who I knew, Herbert Günther, who, for those of you who may know, he's kind of a headache for a lot of people because he's a philosopher and he uses a lot of concepts. But he said it's a difficult word because it's really more openness than, it's an unbounded dimension of being, completely open dimension of being. Empty simply means it's empty of attributes that you can paste on it. You know, again, we don't want to turn it into something. You can't turn emptiness into a thing. Mm-hmm. Empty is empty of itself. It's even empty of any kind of emptiness. Okay? So, you know, we just have to let our minds kind of like, our conceptual minds have to be given a rest. Because they can't grasp what this is. This is why we don't have 500 people in here all waiting, you know, on the edge of their seat to get into non-self and emptiness, right? it's like you got to work at it. I mean, you're engaged with working on yourself, which is a noble thing to do, because it's the basis of transformation.
I can't really wrap my head around the emptiness.
Good.
No. It's easier, you know, so I'm wondering, is it okay, like, to think of openness instead? Because I think I can do openness and spaciousness, and that feels you know, like I have some sort of idea of what it might be.
Why don't you just do that for a while? Yeah. I mean, that's fine.
That's what I had to do. Because emptiness, I'm like, huh?
Yeah, we don't want to get bogged down with emptiness. Oh my God,
I'm lost. I'm like, it's nowhere for me.
It is nowhere.
Yeah,
and the point is that we're simply learning how to train our mind to let go. There's this boundary, and the boundary is our thinking process, our, as he says, logic, and you know, order that we have, that we take on, whether we think it's other people's ideas or our ideas. We're still dealing with stuff that the mind makes, and so we're talking about moving beyond just it, transcending. Okay, you've heard the word transcend. It is a transcendent reality. Reality itself is transcendent. How about that? This is not something totally new. It's just the nature. Reality is transcendent. It transcends the mind's capacity to grasp what it is. That's why it's transcendent. But it's very present, and we can actually experience it very directly, and that's the most important thing. It's not like in some other dimension, some other universe.
And that sounds, you know, like a reachable sort of, you know, things I can, you know, deal with, the emptiness.
Good. No, that's okay, because you're tripped up on a word. It's not the word.
Universe.
It's not the word. Yeah. It's like the finger pointing to the moon. We don't want to get stuck on the finger, you know.
Well, and in a sense, this is not a creed, right? This is, if this is what reality is, then practice will bring it home to us.
That's what we learn. That's why it's not a question of belief. It would be terrible to believe in emptiness. I mean, actually, there's been some statements about this. That people who think, people who think there's a real self in the world is solid are really stupid. But people who think emptiness is real are totally stupid. I mean, just complete imbeciles. So, you know, we want to be careful about, you know, deciding what's real. But, you know, emptiness is a word. That's all.
This is good.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
It's tough to explain real concepts through concepts.
We're not going to explain concepts through concepts. It's non-concepts. We're going to experience it. That's why we're going to practice. So try this when you're in your daily life, try in your daily practice. Try to just be there. And don't have any anticipation of what you might see. But when your mind settles enough and you see a thought arising, just look at where it comes from. It's really simple. You know, we can do that for ourselves and just find out. Because we have to know for ourselves. That's the most important thing. This is not about agreeing with what everybody else says because that's what's cool, you know. So I think it's time. We're completing this. What I want to say is leave that on for a second.
Oh, I'm going to try.
Continue reading that chapter. We're not in any rush to get through this book as much as some people would like to. But really, just look at it again, and we'll be reading the next chapter, which is actually Nirvana is Beyond Concepts, very related to what we're talking about now. So, you know, I think we should bring both of these chapters together next week, think about exploring how the journey that you're making with your meditation practice will help you understand what he's saying in the emptiness. And then beyond the mind, beyond concept, and then how Nirvana is so intimately related to that, because Nirvana is fundamentally release. It's the freedom we're talking about. It's actual, the freedom which is relative to being trapped. When a bird is set free, it feels very good, right? It just flies out of the cage, bingo, right? Animals, you know, which have been kept in confined feeding operations for many of their lives, and then suddenly taken out by somebody who kind of puts them on a farm and bliss out. I mean, they have this wonderful sense of just being what they are, right? I mean, you know, we're still in the world of relative because we're talking about how we can only, we have to start from where we are. And this is all very good. So I really appreciate everybody's participation, and I really appreciate your questions, and I really invite more and more everything. Why am I doing this? Why bother? You know, what's the point of all this? Where are we going to go with this? Those are all good questions. Do I really want to stay in this long? I mean, is it really this? Isn't there something more interesting to do? So let's dedicate the merit. Yeah. By this merit, may all attain perfect awakening, rising above all forces of negativity, going beyond the turbulence of birth, old age, sickness, and death. May all beings be free from the ocean of samsara.
Before everyone leaves, I just kind of want to make an announcement. I told a few people that my life has been kind of in flux lately, and I just recently decided that I'm going to quit my job and move back home. It's been something that I've been toying with for the last few months, and it's really the right thing for me to do. But I really wanted to thank everybody for this group. I mean, I should be here for the next two times, but just in case. It's